back late in the afternoon to start talking about the charge. When we did, an attorney showed up who's not on the record anywhere, Frank Gilstrap, and he brought this issue number one. And I remember telling the judge in chambers, and then later, as the record shows, I objected in the formal charge objections. This is going to place an unfair burden on us. It's going to be a comment on the weight of the evidence. This is a problem because the question number one that these folks are trying to ask you to use includes a paragraph here that's a comment on the weight of the evidence, and I don't think that it's proper to include it. Well, it got included over objection.
And are you objecting to the defensive? I noticed you had that highlighted.
Yes.
Defensive.
Yes. And there are several problems with this. First of all, even if it were a proper submission, it would be a defense submission. It should be like an affirmative defense or inferential rebuttal. But when you put it into the question that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on, it unfairly enhances the plaintiff's burden to get a finding, and at the same time, it constitutes a comment on the weight of the evidence.
Well, I'm going to ask Mr. Maxwell why it's not in the pattern of jury charge and that it was submitted, so I'll give you a heads up.
Well, let me also tell you, and the brief points this out, if you take a look, there's no case law that says this is a civil affirmative defense, but if you take a look in the penal code, under Section 8, it's not a criminal affirmative defense either, but it does show up as apparently an inferential rebuttal to mens rea in the penal code with a comment that says, and I've got it quoted here in the brief, with a comment that says, however, it's not supposed to impair a civil defense in any way. It apparently was intended not to be included in civil cases. It causes all kinds of problems, and it places an impossible burden, especially in a case like this where this is a key issue. This is a closely contested case. Some of the Supreme Court cases I've included on jury charge show that this is the very kind of a case where putting something extra into the charge by way of an instruction or a comment, especially if it's done in error, will skew the process and make the trial unfair. Since
your position not a defense at all, or is your position that it should have been an affirmative defense except the question, or what is your position?
My position is that A, and these are separate independent points, but A, best I can tell, it's not a defense. B, if it were a defense, it would be an affirmative defense, and there ought to be a separate issue on it, or it ought to be an inferential rebuttal instruction, but it should not be included in the plaintiff's issue where it constitutes a comment on the weight of the evidence and unfairly enhances and heightens the burden of the plaintiff to such an extent that it becomes practically impossible for the plaintiff to ever get a finding. And there's a case, the Gibbons case, I think, which I've cited from the Fort Worth court, which is a fairly recent case where something similar happened with an assault instruction with the result that the case was remanded. If I could, I'd like to talk about the Mary Carter problem, because that's a significant problem. And what has happened here is one person, Jesse Small, was controlling the entire defense. One lawyer, his longtime lawyer, Mr. McGuire, defended everyone and then later decided to peel part of it off. So the jury thought there were two lawyers and two sets of defendants, and we tried mightily to get to the jury the evidence that would show the real alignment of the parties.
My recollection of the old Mary Carter Paint Company case was that one of the elements was that one side had to have paid, or one party had to have paid money, and then they were going to get a refund of their money depending on the outcome. That was an element.
Well,
to get a Mary Carter agreement, but you might correct me.
Well, you're right, but you're wrong. The Mary Carter was a closely managed enterprise, as you may or may not know, and they did do that in the Mary Carter case from which the agreement takes its name. However, it was the Elba Orr case, handled when he was in practice by a lawyer who later became a member of this court, that got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, what we don't like about Mary Carter-type agreements is that there is an alignment of the parties that is hidden from the jury. And in fact, that's what was going on here with this Mary Carter agreement. We had one person who was paying for the entire defense, but the jury never knew it. His testimony that I tried to offer showed that he had access to both the lawyers, but the jury never knew it. And his employee was set up as a patsy, and I even told the judge, with the jury out, trying to explain what was going on, I even said, "Judge, here's what'll happen. They'll set this up, and then they'll come back in final argument." And one of the defense attorneys said on the record, and it's even in one of the appendices, "That's crazy." And then, sure enough, they turned around and did it. So it's just something that makes things less than fair. And I'm looking here to see if I can find the case citation. But there's a Waco case that comes along after Elbow War that addresses this more correctly. It's Turoff versus McCaslin. You can find it, for example, at page 43 of the brief. And
is there a written agreement?
There's not a written agreement that I know of, but there is a clear agreement with the principal here who owns the company, paying all the defense costs and having access to all the lawyers. And according to the Turoff case from Waco in 2007, which is one of the cases on the heels of the Elba Orr case, it says, quote, "Texas law does not favor arrangements that tend to skew the trial process, misleading the jury, or promote collusion among nominal adversaries." Well, nominally, the two camps of defendants were adversaries, but in fact, they were colluding because they were basically like two fingers on one glove.
Why were they adversaries? That's a little hard for me to say.
Well, that was set up by Mr. McGuire so that he could claim that Harcourt, who he took as the client, even though he set up the corporation and still keeps their books for Mr. Small, that Harcourt was not acting in course and scope. And sure enough, he put his own client on the stand and asked him questions I couldn't ask because of the limine rulings to show that he was a bad guy. And then right on the heels of it, his client was under supposed cross-examination by Mr. Maxwell, who got him to say that what he was doing certainly wasn't within course and scope. And then that was the argument that they made. In other words, that this guy was a loose cannon. Now, this comes on the heels of the fact that at this business, unbeknownst to my clients when they came there, there was a history of violence. There were people who had criminal troubles. Mr. Small himself, although I tried to impeach him on this and wasn't able to, he had rammed someone's head into a radiator who was a patron and had been convicted of that in this county at an earlier point in time. And the two managers, Mr. Harcourt and Mr. Nixon, and Mr. Nixon has been down at the TDC for some years in his past, these folks had actually gotten into a fight with each other out there at the workplace. So this was a potentially dangerous place for the bishops to be. But they didn't know this, and the way the trial was presented was as though this was a place filled with choir boys and choir girls. And one of my other points is that I tried to present impeachment evidence because Mr. Small was put on the stand by his attorney, and he testified, and I think it's under tab, well, it's one of these tabs, but he testified about how he would never condone any kind of problem, and we thought certainly that had opened the door to the impeachment, but the court would not permit the impeachment, and so I was not able to impeach him. Let's see, it's probably under tabs 4 and 5.
Didn't that have to, well, I don't know the answer to my question, but it got us to a different subject. Wasn't it remoteness in the prior criminal conduct that led to its exclusion?
That wasn't my understanding. The judge went on, there are pages and pages of this, and to be real candid, my belief was that what he was trying to do was just sort of kill it with discussion so there wouldn't be a ruling on it, and I was trying hard to get a ruling and finally did. But the testimony that I was trying to impeach on came down to this, and it's at page 8 within tab 5, for example, lines 15 through 17. Question from Mr. Maxwell, who had his witness on direct, his own client. Yeah. Would assaulting a customer be something you would ever under any circumstances agree with? And the answer was no. What basically happened here?
I'm sorry, but your time's up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying to hurry up.
One little question. Your point of error number two said that the entry of a docket, the making of a docket entry was reversible error.
On that one point, the judge, after 8 o'clock at night on a day when we were all tired, has made what appears to be a Scrivener's error. I did dismiss the DBAs. I did not dismiss AB Auto Salvage.
Have you ever found a case that was reversed because of a document?
Well, Your Honor, I think it ought to be abundantly clear that there's nothing in the record to indicate that I made the dismissal. I didn't make it. I went back and looked at my trial notes, which were detailed. What has happened here?
I just don't see any relevance of that docket entry to any part of your case. Or?
Well, there are several defendants, and some of them are DBAs. And I dismissed the DBAs because we had the principal party there. AB Auto Salvage is not a DBA and was never dismissed. So I brought this up to the trial court as part of my motion for new trial. The judge patiently listened to all of it and immediately overruled all of it. At that point, the only thing I can do is bring it here.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, well, I'll give you a heads up. When you come up for rebuttal, I will ask you if you objected to the charge without the party in it.
Understood. Thank you.
Okay. Steve?
Good afternoon, and may it please this honorable court. First of all, Mr. Reynolds' brief was extremely difficult to respond to because much of it was argument and innuendo and facts that were half true and half not true. And in fact, I want to point out at the beginning of this argument that we have objected to his statement of facts because it doesn't comply with Rule 38 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. It is not a clear and concise summary of the facts with references to applicable parts of the record. It just isn't. And so we have objected to it. Similarly, under Rule 34.6 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, when only a partial reporter's record is requested, it is incumbent upon the person making the request to detail the points and issues on appeal. There's a reason for that. It's kind of obvious. It allows the other side to see, okay, these are the points that are going to be raised by the appellant, and it gives the appellee a chance to see, that's right, the part of the record he's requested will address those points, so we don't need to order anything else. If that rule is complied with, there is a presumption that the part of the reporter's record that is not ordered is not relevant to the points or issues on appeal. However, in this case, that was not done. And therefore, you have the exact opposite to be true, and that is that it is to be presumed when the person who has ordered only a partial record does not specify the points and issues on appeal, then it is to be presumed that the trial court's judgment was correct and was supported by that portion of the record not ordered. Now that becomes very important and part of the argument that I'm going to be giving here. I want to start with the jury charge argument. And Judge McCoy, you will know this better than anybody. You wrote that Gibbons opinion. And you will be able to understand the difference between what that fact situation was and what this fact situation was and kind of see this in the light of what it was intended. First of all, the law on assault, the law on justification, contrary to Mr. Reynolds' brief, is the same, whether it be civil law or criminal law. Now, what happened in the Gibbons case was the incident that had occurred at the Smoke Pit barbecue, and these two individuals had their jaws broken. The charge that was given to the jury in that case was the same basic question on assault that was given in this case. Here's where it was different, though, in the Gibbons case as opposed to the case here at bar. In that case, an instruction on assault, not conditioned on anything else, simply an instruction on assault was given in connection with the issue, followed by an unconditioned instruction on justification. This court, in its opinion, said it is probably the preferred method, and this flies in the face of what Mr. Reynolds suggested a minute ago about these being comments on the weight of the evidence. Clearly, it's not, because this court didn't talk about that in this opinion, but it said probably the better way to do this is to give a first question on assault, a second question on justification, which was not done in the Gibbons case. What the Gibbons case did, and why it presents the problem it did, and why the opinion was written the way it was, is because it would allow a jury to answer yes to assault and also answer yes to justification. If they believe that, and even if they believe there was justification, they could still have answered the assault question yes. What we did in this case, that would not have been possible. To address your question, Judge McCoy, there's not a good issue in the pattern jury charge for how this is done when there is justification. Bear in mind that in the Gibbons case, ultimately this court found that the plaintiff in that case, or excuse me, the defendant, Mr. Gibbons, in that case was not entitled to a justification instruction or an issue on that because he never pled it. It was pled in this case, and what we did is accomplish the exact same result that I think was instructed or at least encouraged by this court's Gibbons opinion. We conditioned the assault instruction with a justification provision. It would have been impossible for this jury to have found that there was an assault if they believed there was justification.
Was this before or after the Castle Doctrine statute?
I'm sorry?
Was this before or after the statute was amended?
I have no idea.
Well, there's no duty to retreat in this instruction. That's why I was asking.
No, I do not know that. I just know that what we ended up doing was getting an instruction that went to the elements of assault conditioned upon, and that's the important issue here, conditioned upon the idea of whether or not there was justification. And again, it would have been impossible for this jury to have found assault if they believe there was justification.
Well, my problem is that if you're going to give a self-defense charge, and the law at the time required the duty to retreat instruction, and there isn't one, then it does seem to be a comment on the weight of the evidence.
I'm sorry, though. This was not exactly a self-defense charge. This was a justification charge, and there is a subtle difference. And in the justification charge, if you look at it, if conduct can be justified, then duty to retreat and the things that you're suggesting, I don't think apply here, Your Honor.
Self-defense is a justification. That's why it's a defense. It's not affirmative defense. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
All right.
I was just telling you my problems.
So, at any rate, we look at it in that context. This jury found no to an assault because the justification provision was included in the definition of assault. You know, looking at this in the broader spectrum of this case, bear in mind also this jury was given a charge on, a question on negligence as well. I think you can get an idea of where the jury looked at these facts and how they interpreted them by the fact that in the negligence portion of the case, they put 70% of the fault on Mr. Bishop and only 30% of the fault on Mr. Harcourt. So, all things considered, when I look at that Gibbons case, I see that the result, by the way this issue was worded, by the way this question was worded, achieved exactly what Judge McCoy pointed out in his opinion on that case and avoided the problem of being able to present a question of assault when there could have also, a finding, I should say, of assault when there was also the ability to find that there was justification for that assault, and yet the two weren't merged properly together. I hope I've stated that properly. Let me go down to the next thing, because I've made a quick list of what Mr. Reynolds pointed out here. The undisclosed witness. First of all, if you check the record, you will not find one objection by Mr. Reynolds to either the undisclosed witness or the testimony of this witness at all. Ruben Garcia was not specifically named as a witness. Now, in a generic way, the custodians of the records of the 911 records for the city of Arlington were named. Now, no objection was made to Mr. Garcia. What was objected to was the attempt to put into evidence the 911 records. Let me tell you why that's not error, for two good reasons. First of all, no one knew better than Mr. Garcia, who, again, not being objected to, could testify about that 911 call. You know why? Because he was the one who actually inputted it, took the call, and logged it in. He knew more about the 911 call than anybody else. So, the question being, can he testify as to those records just because he was not the custodian of those records? Yes, he certainly could, and that's what the court found, that Mr. Garcia himself not being objected to, can there be a valid objection to what he's testifying to as far as those records? And the court found he knew more than anybody about those records, so he could testify. Even if that was not right, it's harmless error, because everything that this man testified to had already come into evidence already. It was not disputed in this case that the other employees of this business placed the 911 call. It was not disputed in this case that after the 911 call had been placed by the other employees, that Mr. and Mrs. Bishop placed a 911 call. That's really all this was about. I don't really know. I think anything that had already come out before this man ever took the stand, he didn't call anybody a suspect. All he was doing was alluding to the records of these 911 calls being made. I think that from the standpoint of the police, from the standpoint of the records, anybody who is the subject of a 911 call about an assault is going to be a suspect until facts are sorted out. So there was nothing new that would have come from this testimony. No impeachment allowed of Jesse Small. Now, bear in mind, Jesse Small was never present, not for 1 second of this entire altercation. He is the owner of the business.
Your time's up.
Oh, thank you.
May it please the court. I thought that the major part of this was going to be discussed already, and I think all the salient points have been touched. I would like to make some observations with regard to the presentation of Mr. Reynolds with regard to the undisclosed witness. It's kind of coming to look like in his brief that it was important that he was referred to as a suspect, and that that's what we wanted it in evidence for. That's not what was important in the record. What was important in the record was, number one, it was a contemporaneous record of the event as it unfolded, had happened. Not only that, but it, about every minute or every 2 minutes, there was a reference to the time. And it would appear after the entire incident was over, from beginning to end, it was about 4 minutes. Now, that doesn't sound like what was pled in this case. I hope you've looked at the pleadings. The pleadings are 30 pages long. They describe that the plaintiffs had come into a dangerous place filled with dangerous and violent individuals. That the place was run by a person who was dangerous and capable of great violence. That the plaintiffs unwittingly came into a death trap. And that the defendants made a vicious, unprovoked attack, during which the plaintiff was hit, choked, kicked in the side, stomped on the chest in the vicinity of his cardioverter, causing his heart to stop beating and rendering him clinically dead. Now, that's not all. There's the next set of paragraphs go on describing something that sounds like it's going to last 15, 20 minutes. But bear in mind, all of these horrible beatings lasted only 4 minutes. What you don't have is anything really in this record that shows a severe beating? In the trial court, there were over 100 photographs. Over 100 photographs. None of them, I don't think any of them have been brought up here. There's some photographs, but I don't remember them being of Mr. Bishop claiming evidence of where he was beaten. I think the evidence that is up here showed that Mr. Bishop had had a severe heart attack, that he had a cardioverter implanted in his chest wall, which is both a pacemaker and a defibrillator. And what happened during this little fracas out there was that Mr. Bishop literally fainted. That's all that happened to him. He wasn't beaten to death. He fainted. And when that machine that he had in his chest sensed what was going on, it ordered the machine to fire. Now, the firing of the machine had nothing to do with bringing him back to life. It stopped his heart. I thought everybody knew that. All it did was stop his heart, and he's got a pacemaker built inside his heart, and he's also got one installed in his chest, and that's what started his heart beating in a regular sinus rhythm. He wasn't dead. He wasn't clinically dead, and in spite of what that doctor testified, I think it was patent nonsense. I wish we had the entire record up here. I didn't object to bringing the entire record up here, because the entire record certainly supports this verdict in this case.
But that can't hurt you, the failure to have the entire record. It should favor you, not hurt you. Shouldn't it?
I didn't object to it, Judge. I didn't object to him having the full record. I wasn't especially wild about it happening, but
does it hurt you that there's not a full record?
Oh, I think it certainly does. It certainly does. I'd like for all of you to have looked at those nearly 100 photographs of injuries he claimed to have received and not a bruise on any of them. Now, that's not in the record.
Didn't you have the opportunity to ask?
We did. We did. We certainly did. But I thought we could handle it with what was there rather than undergo the expense. And I think I attached something to show it was quite a bit more that would have cost to bring this entire record up.
Time's up.
Thank you.
Is your rebuttal?
I think I have rebuttal. And I'll answer any question, but I'd like about 30 seconds to set things straight a little about this business of the record. First of all, trying to be thoughtful of the reporter in a pro bono case, we didn't ask for an entire record to start with. But later, I did ask for an entire record, and that was resisted. And this court took that under advisement, and we didn't get an entire record. I was willing to have an entire record once the point had been raised. And these defense attorneys are working hand in glove, so I think my point is this. We tried to be considerate, and we had great difficulty even at that getting the record. I'm sure the court reporter is very busy. When the point was raised, we asked for the record. All of the points that we've raised on appeal were raised in the motion for new trial. Nobody's surprised by this. This is a case, this is the first, in fact, I'll tell you, I believe I'm right. I think this is the first pro bono case argued since the appellate section started doing pro bono stuff, unless y'all are aware of one that's preceded it. It's a pro bono case. I have a client who is a pauper. I told her that I would handle this for her without any fee for the appellate work, and that's how it's been done. To the extent there have been incidental charges for copies or whatever, I've paid for them. Because she qualifies for a record, she got a free record. And Mr. McGuire himself just said, well, he thought we could get by with the record anyway. That's part of what the recording of today's proceedings will show him saying. I don't think we had a fair and proper trial. I don't think we had an attentive jury. We had a lot of difficulty with the jury. We had jurors sleeping. The judge tried to control them. It didn't seem to work. But then later we had the judge telling them, well, I'm going to leave. you've got to take a lunch break, you're going to have to leave by 4:30 because we've got a visiting judge. And so their solution was they took a long lunch break, and in less than an hour and a half, with lots of evidence, they had returned a verdict. We had interludes where they were laughing. We had times when they were saying, and it's captured on the record, they wished they could leave. We had one juror who did leave. The whole process of this trial was not fundamentally fair. I believe there was charge error. I believe there were significant errors in evidentiary rulings. On behalf of my client, I'm asking that this case be remanded for a retrial.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. I was sort of curious where you were going with the notation about non-suit, and was that party not submitted in the charge, and did you object? And I mean, that's your complaint, was that I wanted these people, a question asked about them, but because of the docket entry?
We had discussions at the time of the charge conference, off the record discussions. We all had discussions about who do we need to submit and who's a DBA, and if we submit this, does that take care of that? I don't think that there was a submission of AB, but I think the understanding was that if we got findings, AB was in the loop. What I didn't do was dismiss AB. I dismissed the DBAs.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is if AB is not in the charge and you don't have vicarious liability or master servant or something, how do you get to them anyway, and so what difference does it make?
It's because of the way they're structured. There's a partnership arrangement. There's vicarious liability because of the people that are submitted, including their manager, who is Harcourt, and also there were issues about their manager, Nixon. Both of them were managers. One managed the Ford operation, one managed the Chevy operation. And so there definitely were claims of vicarious liability. And my recollection is that the general thought on behalf of everyone on both sides of the bench was, if you get the findings of culpability on the part of the agent, then the master becomes liable. That's why I did not dismiss AB, but I dismissed the DBAs because they were just DBAs for another party, just one party going by several names. So what has happened here, I'm confident, is this. It was after 8 at night when we finished that night. The judge has made a ruling. It's not consistent with my contemporaneous notes, and I went back and checked them, or with my recollection. I think he's made a scrivener's error here. But if the case is remanded for trial and we get findings against the individual who is the agent, and the master has been dismissed, then we have a problem. And that's why I've raised this point.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your argument today. Your case is submitted. Your argument was very helpful. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. We appreciate the courtesy of being permitted to be here.
All right, you are excused to go about your business, or if you want to hang around and watch the next few cases, you're welcome to do that too. And if the lawyers for